We have two distinct flavors of radiation that we're going to talk about, okay? The first one we have is ionizing radiation. This is the stuff like power plants, things like that. And of course, non-ionizing radiation, which is what we're pretty much surrounded with on a daily basis. Ionizing radiation in that sufficient energy exists with the radiation to ionize either atoms or molecules. Well, what does that mean? Basically, an ion is an atom or a molecule that has either an excess or a deficit of electrons. So it has a net electrical charge. It's not neutral. We're changing the chemical properties of the compound. Here's a schematic of what's happening with it. Our radiation comes in, hits a little electron, shoots this guy off, and we get a little refraction and heads off a different direction. Okay. We consider ionizing radiation under a couple different flavors. We have alpha particles, we have the beta particles, and the gamma rays. Okay. We can also use X-rays in that as well. An X-ray is basically less energy than a gamma ray. The gamma ray is kind of the highest energy that we're going to see before you get into the cosmic stuff. Here's what takes place when we look at the three, the alpha, beta, and the gamma. You can see that just a sheet of ordinary paper like you'd have on a tablet or something like that is going to stop your alpha particle radiation. The beta, which is just a little bit more energetic, it's going to take something like aluminum foil to stop. And when we get to the gamma, which is the really nasty, make you glow in the dark stuff, it's going to get through both of those. It's going to take some lead to stop it, and you can see you're even going to get a little bit on the other side. Okay? Now, our alpha and beta particles are actually physical matter, and they're not electromagnetic radiation. Okay? That's a distinction between the rest of them and some of the other forms of the non-ionizing that we're going to see. Here's an alpha particle. Here's a diagram of it. Basically what it is, it's a helium nucleus. Okay? It's a nucleus of a helium atom. It's comprised of two protons and two neutrons. Okay? So it has some mass. You could actually stop it and weigh it if you wanted to. Our beta particle, he's going to be a lot smaller in size. Notice the difference in the size between the two. And what he is going to be either a free electron or a free positron. What's a positron? That's antimatter. So we're off into the Star Trek stuff here right now. It does exist, but what a positron does is it has a positive charge as opposed to a negative charge in the electron. And these guys are going to have a greater velocity than an alpha particle is going to have. Okay, the gamma rays and the X-rays are electromagnetic waves. We talked about that. It's basically the same stuff as light, RF, things like that, but it exists at a higher frequency and hence a higher energy. Remember our equation we talked about in the past, the speed of light is equal to the frequency times the wavelength. Okay? As you increase the frequency, the wavelength's going to decrease, and as a consequence of that, the energy also goes up. Now, our visible light frequency, what we've got here, exists in the range of 400 to 790 terahertz. Our X-ray frequency is going to be a little bit higher at 30 petahertz to 30 exahertz, and then the gamma rays take over when we get to the top end of the hard X-rays here. All right, well, you're asking, what is a terahertz? Well, terahertz is 1,000 gigahertz. So our light bulbs here are really nice 400,000 gigahertz microwave transmitters. Okay? Say that real quick and see if anybody, what they think. Okay, petahertz, we're going to add another factor of 1,000 there. So it's basically a million gigahertz. And with the exahertz, we're going to add another factor of 1,000. So we can see that these guys are oscillating pretty quickly. This is every second, these number of cycles every second. Okay, as we mentioned, the high energy is going to ionize atoms. Ionization damages DNA. Okay, it's going to change the chemical composition of the DNA. This is why when we talk about ionizing radiation, it's such nasty stuff. Because at the biological level, it actually causes substantial proven health risks. Now, the reason I've underlined the proven here is when we talk about the non-ionizing with the RF, there is some theory out there that it's going to cause some problems, but we haven't really fully proven all the glow-in-the-dark scenario that the NIMBY and the banana people say, okay? So this is something to remember if you get into a situation where maybe you're building an array, building a tower, something like that. You are going to have people in the neighborhood, they're going to freak out about their kids. Knowing this difference can hopefully allay some of their fears. So our radiation comes in, hits a cell, splits the DNA. Look, we get Mr. Cancer Cell. He turns into a tumor, okay? Now, the non-ionizing radiation is different, completely different from our ionizing radiation in terms of the energy. It is insufficient to ionize atoms. But does it affect the atoms or the molecules? And the answer to that is yes. Our examples are visible light, of course, sound, heat, broadcast auxiliaries, that's your STL stuff. and of course our venerable AM, FM, and TV broadcasts. These are all examples of non-ionizing radiation. What does it do? Well, it affects the vibrational or rotational energy of an atom, the kinetic energy. Any of you guys are chemists out here, what happens if the kinetic energy of something goes up? Heat. I heard somebody said heat. Exactly. So in other words, you may get heating. Now, I emphasize the may on here because if the mass is sufficiently large or for other extenuating circumstances, maybe cooling or something like that, there may not be a definitive temperature rise, although you may see some changes in the rotation and that of the molecules. This is our microwave oven concept, okay? We're going to put some food in a cavity, irradiate it with some microwave energy, and that's going to cause the water to vibrate quicker, okay? Important to remember that an intense flood of non-ionizing, you can put light on you all day long, and it's not going to ionize anything, okay? The only difference is if it heats it enough to cause spontaneous, but that's a different process, okay? Public doesn't know the difference, and of course, their assumption is they are going to glow in the dark regardless of what the source is and what type of energy it is. Okay, standard deal, ahead of myself here. Numerous standards have been developed over the years, okay? We're not just sort of limited to the United States. There have been numerous ones that have been done throughout the world. The United States was kind of some of the pioneer on some of this. And our standards, of course, continue to evolve. As we learn more about medicine, we have different ways of looking at things. They tend to change things. The first standard that the United States had was sponsored by IEEE in 1960. It's called the C95 Project. The American National Standards Institute, ANSI, also co-sponsored this. What's interesting is it took them 6 years of research before they actually got the standard out. Okay? This is a very, very rudimentary standard compared to what we have in effect today. You can see it was revised subsequently six other times, or five, I guess, I can't see. Important, what's interesting here is in 1992, the revision actually came out in 1992, but it has a 1991 designation on it. So when you see me talk about the 91 version, that's actually the revision that was approved in 1992. In addition, we also have the NCRP, which is the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements. They've issued some additional standards, and these guys kind of deal more with the power plant type of stuff, medical applications, things like that. But they sort of glommed on to the non-ionizing and did end up doing a standard. Our current FCC standard, it's actually a hybrid. It's a hybrid of two different standards. It's a hybrid of the 91, which is the revision that came out in 92, and then some exposure limits that were proposed by NCRP in 1986. So you can see that stuff's actually been around for quite a while, and the FCC has not revised the standard, all right? Now, other countries, of course, are going to use some varying standards. Canada has one called Safety Code 6. They most recently updated theirs in about 2009. Japan has a standard which basically tracks the FCC standard. Okay, so when you take the IEEE, the Canadian, the FCC, and there's a European one, those are pretty much the four that are prevalent throughout the world. And everybody else has sort of taken bits and pieces and created their own. There's another group, ICNIRP. They have a standard also. If you Google this, you can find it. It's very interesting to read. It's a kind of a European type of thing that the EU is using. Okay, under our standard, this should be old hat. You guys should know this. We talk about the controlled and the uncontrolled environments. Okay, the uncontrolled pertains to the general population, those areas where you have absolutely no control over the exposure, and you have no control over the population and what they're going to do. Okay. The controlled, obviously, is those where we have people that are cognizant, like yourselves, perhaps tower workers, contractors, stuff that people have gone through training. So they're aware of the hazards. They know what can happen if they're exposed to too much. And we can control their exposure. That's the big thing. All right? You can limit how much they're exposed to. You have practices in place that say, hey, you can't go in this area or time exposure if you're in this area. Just a couple examples. Your parking lot is an uncontrolled environment. All right? You're going to have just general people coming to the station. Anything that's not fenced off would be considered uncontrolled. Your tower, obviously controlled. Okay. What's interesting to note is that the upper limits that are permissible for the frequency ranges that we care about, you'll find that the uncontrolled environment limits are about 20% or 1/5 of what's permitted in the controlled environment. Okay. Here's a graph that shows you basically the power density limits, and actually in terms of field, because here's the electric field and here's the magnetic field. You can see this is the uncontrolled environment here. That's a logarithmic scale, so that's why it's really, it doesn't look like it's 1/5. But as we get down here, we're getting down into the range of stuff we don't really care about as broadcasters, so the two limits are identical. Same thing when we get up here. But through this area where we really care about, you can see the differential between the two. This is based on the 1991 limits, and this is the current FCC limits. This is what you have to comply with at your facility. Okay, we cannot under or overstate the importance of having an RF safety plan. All right. The 2005 revision, as I mentioned earlier, absolutely requires that to be in place. Now, granted, the 2005 revision is not fully authorized or accepted by the commission, but if you get into a legal situation, you may get asked the question of, hey, is there something out there that's a newer standard? A savvy attorney for the other side is going to know about this, and they're going to raise this up, this question, why didn't you have a plan in place? Obviously, the use of a plan is going to protect humans from exposure. That's key. Safety is paramount above absolutely anything else that we do. Okay? If we kill somebody, the bottom line at the end of the day really doesn't matter. Okay? This is important to the GMs and the owners. You're going to reduce your liability if you have a plan in place. Okay? Suddenly, you've taken something that is a negligent type of violation to something that is accidental in nature. And in terms of damages and things like that, we're talking factors of 10. Or possibly even more, depending on how sympathetic the jury is to what happened. Publicity, another big thing that we got to worry about, okay? If you do have an accident, somebody gets hurt, the media comes in. Well, obviously, we're media, so you can probably control it, except for the competition across town. Exactly. You're going to reduce your publicity issues. You'd say, yeah, we had an accident, but it was an accident. We were looking out for it. We took care of things. We just simply had an accident. And that makes what could be a very big problem go away quite easily. Of course, insurance costs, that's another bottom line thing. Okay, this is kind of like having the OnStar for your car. And if you have a GM product, if you have OnStar, it takes like 15% off your insurance rates. All right. A lot of times you'll find that if you go to your carrier and they're savvy enough and tell them this, they'll probably decrease your rates a little bit. Okay, the elements of the safety plan, we have a number of main categories that we look at. First, of course, since it is a safety plan, it's a plan, we're going to have administrative overhead involved with it. Also going to look at an inventory of sources. We need to catalog what's there at the site. Okay. Going to assess your exposure. What problems do we have? Where are the problems? Things like that. How do we address them? Once we know what level of exposure problems we have, then we can start designing controls. And what the control is basically a way of limiting your access. It's a procedure that is put into place, whether administratively or engineering-wise, to handle a particular situation. If these guys climb above this point on the tower, we have to shut down this antenna. Okay, that type of thing. That's a control. Obviously, if it's a plan, it doesn't do any good if nobody knows about it. So we're going to get into education, training, and audit. Anytime you have a plan, you don't want to just put it on the shelf and leave it, so you want to come back and look at it down the road. And then finally, we've got to throw in ancillary hazards. What's an ancillary hazard? Well, it's anything that can happen when you're that's not related to the task at hand. And I'll show you some examples of that at the end. Okay, first and foremost, your plan's got to be written. All right, you got to have it down. We're all pretty smart guys. We have a lot of stuff floating around in our heads, but it's insufficient to have it just floating around in your head. It's got to be available for inspection, okay? You have to be able to refer to it and to show it to others if they would ask for it. An unwritten plan is legally non-existent, okay? If you go into court and they say, where's your plan? Well, you know, we sort of do this and do that. If it's not written down, it's going to be viewed as an unexistent plan. You have to designate an RF safety officer. This would probably make sense to be somebody reasonably technically savvy, such as yourselves, a facility engineer. It could be somebody in management as well, but you have to have a key person, a contact person, that's going to handle all the RF safety issues for the facility. Okay, the duties of the RFSO, you're going to have, and there's 17 of them here, you're going to have to do continuous site evaluation, all right? Keep track of your site, know exactly what's taking place with it. Maintenance of your source inventory. Every time something gets added or taken away, you need to make the proper notes, document it, and then make the changes. Evaluate your existing procedures, okay? Obviously, if we add another source here, maybe a current procedure is going to be insufficient. We add another antenna, hey, we got to drop the levels at where we have to start thinking about switching guys over. document the program, okay? As we mentioned, if it's not written, it's no good. So the RFSO is going to be in charge of documenting the program and maintaining it. Monitor legal requirements, all right? You don't have to be totally 100% up to speed on everything, but you need to keep an eye on what's taking place and see if there are any new developments coming down the pike. Then you can consult with perhaps your consulting engineer. There are a number of firms that deal specifically in this area as well, okay? Disseminate the policy of the organization. Once again, if it's in your top desk drawer and nobody else knows about it, it really doesn't do a lot of good, okay? Advice to the staff. Anytime you put a plan out or some sort of procedure that comes out of the engineering office, you're probably going to have the front office people going to come up and ask questions about it. So you need to know enough about it to be able to give them any kind of advice. All right? Stick to the plan, though. Don't get off the plan. And then authorize and review your surveys and controls. From time to time, you're going to want to resurvey the facility. And you're also maybe going to need to revise some of your controls. So this is another key duty of the RFSO. Maintain a listing of approved personnel, okay? If you got Schickel Gruber Tower Service coming in, who maybe is, you know, two guys with, taking the back wheel off a pickup truck to hoist stuff up, yeah, I see some heads nodding, you guys are familiar with that. They may not be as savvy on some of these issues as maybe some of your more top-tier type of erection companies. So this is where you can maintain a list of, hey, you haven't been through the training, you guys don't know about this, you don't get to come on my site. Okay, manage medical assessments for exposures. Notice I said manage here, all right? This doesn't mean you gotta be the doctor, doesn't mean you have to make the diagnosis, but you gotta manage any exposures that might happen. Keep track of them, keep the necessary paperwork trail that has to follow on it. Coordinate your safety training and maintenance records. Once again, you don't necessarily have to conduct the training, but you do have to coordinate as a safety officer. You can bring somebody else in externally to do that for you if you so desire. Conduct yourself or arrange for a site audit. Once again, you may decide that another pair of eyes is more beneficial to the program. It might help you see something that maybe you overlooked. Once again, manage here again investigation of policy issues. You may not necessarily want to investigate them, but you do need to manage them as the safety officer. Develop and approve hazard assessment tools, okay? So what type of procedures are we using to assess the hazards? Are we doing it through calculations at the desk, which is perfectly acceptable? Are we doing it through measurements? And if we do it through measurements, what type of measurements? Are we doing a broadband or a frequency specific, okay? All these will be things you'll have to look at as you develop the plan. If you have a three-tower AM array out in the middle of a field and there's nobody else on it, well, doing a frequency-specific site audit is not necessarily important because there's only one source. Take the hyperbole on the other example, something like Mount Wilson, Cirrus Tower, it's always going to be Cirrus Tower. Places like that where you have multiple sites, you're going to want to look at a situation where it's frequency-dependent because the aggregate may not give you a proper indication of what's taking place. You may have one guy who's really, really hot that's causing problems, and rather than disturb a whole bunch of people, you can take one guy off the air or switch him to another antenna. Okay, range for calibration and measurement devices. This is if you have any. We're talking about stuff like if you'd happen to have your own Nardometer, Radman, any equipment that you might use to measure this stuff on your own, you're going to have to arrange for the calibration and repair of that. And maintain the archive and the control of the documentation. Right? Control is important. That way you don't have somebody going in and changing your plan around, changing your procedures without you knowing about it. Okay, for the hazard identification, we're going to do a complete inventory of sources at the facility. And we're going to include, this is common sense, we're going to include the type and all the technical parameters associated with it. Okay, antenna, height, power levels, frequencies, things like that. We're going to classify them as intentional emitters. Now obviously an intentional emitter is going to be your antenna. It's intentionally emitting something, okay? Unintentional emitters. How many TV guys do we have out here? Okay, we've got some TV guys. What's an unintentional emitter? Get a problem with your IoT, you got an unintentional emitter, don't you, inside the cabinet. Had more of that with the Klystrons, where you had, you know, the nice X-ray warning and things like that on. So the unintentional emitter is going to be stuff like that. It can also be stuff, if you got a CRT and something goes wrong, it can throw it out. So you're going to want to keep track of all these intentional and unintentional emitters. Now this can get kind of out of hand. So you need to use a little bit of judicious sampling when you do it. But be cognizant that it's not just the transmitter and the antenna. Okay, there are a number of other sources that can cause a problem. Once you have this in place, you can do some initial basic calculations. If you go to the Commission's website, you can go to the Office of Engineering and Technology. We have OET Bulletin 65. There are plenty of equations in there that will help you calculate things. You can look up isotropic radiation. That will give you another way of doing it. And so there are plenty of calculations you can make. So you want to do an initial estimate and see if you have a problem. Once you do that, then you can do some measurement if you think you have a problem, or you can do some modeling of the sources. And this is where we get into something that's a little bit more deeper. Perhaps you think you're right on the edge, and maybe we want to categorically exclude something as a problem. Okay. As I mentioned, your measurement's going to be dependent on your source nature and dependent on the site's the nature of the site as well. Okay, the hazards, we categorize them in four basic categories here. Our first one is, if it's a category number one, our action level is not exceed. When we talk about the action level, that is your uncontrolled environment condition. Okay, that's your general population exposure for anybody that's out there. In this particular case, you have no control actions that are required, okay? Except if you're doing maintenance or other work that might cause it to exceed the uncontrolled environment. Right. Anytime we see that uncontrolled, you have to start looking at putting the plan or the controls into effect. Our next category, what we're saying here is that, okay, our exposure limit, which is going to be the controlled environment limit, that's the stuff that applies to us, to the tower guys, those that are cognizant, it is not exceeded. And in this particular case, it's going to be scenario dependent. Okay. Well, what do I mean by scenario dependent? Well, in one particular case, it could be you reduce the transmitter power, okay? In another, it may be switched to an alternate antenna at a different site or somewhere else on the site, or it could be cease operation. So depending on what the conditions are, the level and that, this is going to be a highly dependent thing, and that's going to be up to your plan. Three is when we get to the potential to exceed the operational exposure level, right? This is when we start getting in close proximity to the antenna. And once again, this is a scenario dependent. Do we shut it off? Do we switch it somewhere else, et cetera? And finally, the granddaddy's number four, and that's when we have exceeded the limit. And basically what you have to do here is you have to take whatever action is necessary to get you back down into one of these other categories, okay? Or obviously prevent access. That's another way of doing it. But if we're doing maintenance on an antenna or something like that, obviously preventing access is not within the scope of work. Okay, we take the controls and we're going to categorize them under two main areas. We're going to have what we call an engineering control, and we're going to have what we call administrative controls. We're also going to look at personal protective equipment and training and education. Now, under an engineering control, what we're talking about there is we're changing the equipment configuration to minimize the exposure potential. This is our change antennas, shut things down, things like that. If you have a multi-user site, such as the big tower out here, Sears, Mount Wilson, as I mentioned, you can change a site configuration to minimize exposure potential. This tower goes off while they're doing particular work, or they're working in this area, that type of a control. Implementation of a physical barrier to restrict access, okay? Now, barrier, of course, only works if it's something that you can really, really control as the RF safety officer. A rope across, some sort of an area, that's not probably a valid engineering control because it can be circumvented quite easily. We talk about a physical barrier, we're talking about something that's locked, okay? Like a locked access point, something to that effect. Interlocks, including lockout and tagout. Now, what's going to be interesting, as you'll see this in a minute, is a lockout and a tagout can also fall under administrative control. And when we get to that, I'll explain why. So interlocks, and that's, of course, is the safest way to, or the lockout tagout is usually the safest way to do it. And the engineering controls are going to be more effective than administrative control. All right. Basically, if you are the one implementing the control and you have full control over that, it's an engineering control. Okay. If you are calling somebody and asking them to do something and you're not physically locking it out yourself or making the change, then that falls under the guise of administrative control. And obviously, in that particular case, it can be circumvented, whether through nefarious purposes or just accident. Administrative controls are going to be work procedures and practices. But why is this administrative? Well, despite our best efforts to give procedures, people can still screw up and circumvent those procedures, okay? So this is administrative. It's not a hard, fast control. Reduction of operating power, okay? We can reduce it, but the guy who comes in on the next shift may decide, hey, something's wrong here, and hit the remote and turn it back up, okay? Cessation of operation. All right, unless you have absolute control and you've done the physical lockout, calling somebody and saying, hey, shut the transmitter off, that's another administrative control. Why, of course? Because it can be turned back on at will. All right. Time averaging the exposure. Once we hit the 100% level, then we can start looking at time averaging. There's a certain amount of subjectivity involved here. You can also, once again, circumvent that, so that's why that falls under the administrative control. Personal monitors. Okay, everybody seen the little rad man, looks like a cell phone or a pager? Yeah, beeps when you get into a higher F area. Those are okay in certain environments, but in other environments, they tend to become an annoyance. Well, they're probably an annoyance because they're reading something that's problematic, and a lot of times the guys will say, throw it in the bucket, okay? So once again, a control that can be circumvented, so it's administrative. Lockout, tagout. Why is this administrative? I call you up and say, hey, go lock out the transmitter. You call me back and say, yeah, it's locked up or locked out, but I haven't actually gone and physically checked it or physically put the lock on itself and put the key in my pocket. It's an administrative control, okay? So this is a situational dependent thing. It depends on who has the physical access to make the change. Proper signage. Everybody got signs up? Yeah? Okay. Just a note on signs. Need to use the appropriate sign at the appropriate location. Okay, we're going to use signs to demarcate the boundaries of the condition. So when we hit the lowest action tier, we're going to use the blue sign, then we're going to move to the yellow and then to the orange, depending on what the level of exposure is. One sign per location, all right? Doesn't make any sense to have more than one because you're providing a confusing message. This is not an appropriate way to do your signage. Now, I could have bought it if this was the notice and maybe the caution was down here and the warning was up here. But even in a vertical order, they're totally out of place. This was on a cell site tower, just so it was not a broadcaster that did this. So that is, if your notices are on your site like that, that's obviously an issue. Okay, personal protective equipment. Under this control, as the safety officer, you're going to procure the necessary equipment. Well, what could this equipment be? Well, it could be a Radman, it could be a suit, something like that, okay? You're also going to be responsible for inspection of this equipment. All right, remember, the suits are not a panacea. If you get a cut in them or there's damage to the integrity of them, they're non-functional, okay? Maintain the equipment, we all know about that. That's kind of a given. Repair and replace, stuff is gonna get worn out and broken over time, so you need to be aware of the wear, the duty cycle, things like that, and take appropriate actions on that. Here's a big one, train in the use of the equipment, okay? Once again, you don't necessarily have to provide the training, but you need to make sure that it is undertaken properly. And as I mentioned, it's not a panacea, okay? The RF suits, in addition to having cuts in them and causing problems like that, they do have a specified attenuation level. And if you are in a field environment that exceeds that, you are not protected by it. So just because you got the Radman, the suit, you can't ignore the rest of the potential issues. Okay, more on the safety plan controls. The measures that we're gonna take are gonna depend on our category. That's our 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on what the exposure level is. Three typical options when you lay out your plan and your controls. Either it's not applicable, it's optional, or it's required, okay? If it's category 1 and we're under the uncontrolled environment, everything's gonna be not applicable there, okay? As we start moving up, then you're gonna move into these guys. The RF safety plan is not required for category 1 if we stay below. We mentioned that a little bit ago. And if it may exceed environments for whatever reason, then you have to have the plan in effect. And controls, I think we beat this to death. That's your procedures that you have to implement with the plan. Okay, it is required of all FCC licenses. If you go back and look at your license, you're gonna see the licensee must, in coordination with other users, reduce power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, okay? So you must coordinate. This is not an option, all right? There have been guys that have had some serious problems with their renewals because they've failed to take this into account. Even if you're the sole user of the site, you by default will necessarily have to have some controls. Okay? It's obvious. If you have to coordinate or you have to make sure that the workers are not exposed, you're going to necessarily have some controls in place. Most of us are going to be, we're going to shut the transmitter off when you go up the tower. Okay? That's a control, but the point is those are going to be in place even if nobody else is at your site. Okay, training, education, audit. If you are doing the training, what you're going to want to do is describe and discuss the RF exposure limits, sort of what we've done here today. Describe and discuss the exposure effects. Primarily what we're talking about here is the heating in the body tissue. How does that manifest itself? Well, it's sometimes there are some behavioral things that are reversible. I find that I get headaches if I get into something that's a little bit higher RF than what it should be. I don't know if anybody else has any anecdotal evidence. So there are some effects you're going to see. That's all published with the standards, so you can work through that as you develop your plan. Describe and discuss your mitigation controls. That's basically inform your personnel what steps you're going to take place depending on what is happening with the work. Okay. Describe your relevant work procedures. This is acceptable, this is not acceptable. Advise of medical device and implant issues. Okay. This tends to be more of a problem with our microwaves and things like pacemakers. Okay. But if you have somebody that maybe has some steel implants, surgical implants, usually they're probably not going to be climbing a tower, but maybe around the base of 50 kilowatt AM or something like that. Okay, so you need to advise anybody that's going to be working as part of your plan that if they have implants, they may have to take some special precautions. Discuss your procedures to address accidents. Once again, an accident's an accident, so we can talk all we want about avoiding them, but sometimes they really do just happen. Your procedures to address exposure. What happens if somebody does get overexposed? Okay. What kind of a plan do we put into there? We obviously are going to get medical help and things like that. This is not all technical. Remember, we've media blackout, things like this. Okay. Basically, when something happens, everybody's running around like chickens with their heads cut off. It's a panic mode. This is basically to reset everything and say, hey, let's follow the checklist, work our way down if we got a problem. Employee involvement in the program. Okay, this is important. If your employees, your staff members are involved, they feel like they have ownership in it, allow them to make recommendations, allow them to ask questions, things like that. Periodic review. Okay, obviously we change sources, things like that. We need to look at that. So review is very, very important with it. And of course the audit, that can be external. Okay, doesn't have to necessarily be internal. Okay, your ancillary hazards. These are the things that, and this is not an exhaustive list by any means, but just some of the stuff to think about. When you're dealing with RF, we're usually talking about stuff being generated by high voltages. So there is a possibility of electric shock, okay? Maybe they're working on the tower lights. There's another way, okay? Thermal burns, okay? We don't have 100% efficiency in RF generation, so there's going to be waste heat. So thermal burns is a real hazard that needs to be addressed. Ionizing radiation, we talked about that. Do you have a problem with a tube or something like that that may be causing some x-rays to emanate? Mechanical issues, okay? Mechanical issues is, we're putting up this new antenna and we dropped it, okay? So there are always going to be some extra hazards that you need to look at in that vein. Falls, okay? Trip hazards, all right? I'm in taking a look at your antenna, or Rich is in taking a look at your antenna. We got extension cord strung out across the building, and somebody walks in and trips on it. Okay. Something just to think about and to make sure that you have properly addressed. Hot work hazards. This is stuff like acetylene, soldering, welding. When we start looking at changing transmission line sections, I mean, if you got a burnout, we're going to manufacture something in the field. How do you address that? Now, when you go to places like, for instance, and I'll use Sears as an example, you actually have to get a hot work permit from building security. And they say, okay, here's your permit. We allow you to do whatever you got to do. And they notify the fire department and things like that. So, I'm going to solder a field flange on. You want to keep from burning the building down. Heat stress, okay? Once again, off-air emergency situation, we're going to be working to get the RF restored, but everybody's going to be under the gun. Okay, if it's July or August in the Midwest, working 12, 13 hours outside may take the toll on the physical body. So you want to keep that in mind as well. And finally, MSDS related hazards. That's your stuff like alcohol, any of your solvents that you would use to clean. Gasoline falls under that. Diesel fuel, any chemical stuff. All right, any questions? Or discussion? Art. Oh, yeah, it's way on the mic, sorry. Art?
One of the things that I didn't see addressed here, but that I've run into, no matter what you're doing or what you're wearing, when you're in the area of an RF field and you have to be working near the base of the tower while it's on, don't count on anything you're wearing or that you have on to protect you, because whatever it is you are wearing is going to act like the dielectric of a capacitor. You're yeah. still a part of the circuit.
Yeah.
That's really a really important consideration that almost nobody ever considers, especially on AM.
Exactly, especially when you're talking to one of the big clear guys or something like that. And I get a little twitchy when I get around some of them, just because it's just kind of a voodoo thing. But you're absolutely right, and that would be something that you would address under your exposure assessment. Okay, so when you're going through that, saying, okay, we know that. And with AM, of course, we have an additional hazard. We have the physical contact hazard that you have as well. Not only the arcing and the capacitance of the dielectric, but you can touch it and get the RF burn. So that would fall under the exposure assessment category. And when you start looking at what exposures you have, remember that that's one that you got to keep in mind, consider.
And it isn't the towers. We are only the base of the towers.
Agreed. But power, in the sense of, yeah.
Do you have any sample websites we can go to find some samples of RF safety plans to make sure as we review, make sure we've got everything included we want to have? What do you suggest there?
I'll tell you what you can do. Send me an email and I'll send you some. I didn't put any up here because what I don't want to do is publicly do that for a liability issue. You're also probably, a lot of that stuff is not going to be highly published for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's the liability. But secondly, it's how some guys make their living. And so they're going to be, less inclined to publicly put that stuff out there. But send me an email, and I'll send you a couple links. NARDA, by the way, NARDA does have one that gives you sort of a real basic overview in trying to set it up.
Is your presentation available? Did you make that available to the WBA?
Yeah, I always make mine available. Okay. And the other thing, too, if you guys go to our website, which is just a www in front of that, I get them archived on there. Everyone that I've pretty much ever done, I have archived on there. I know Linda's going to have this available at some point.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, John.
Anyways, as far as this tower goes and your tenants, is it required that it be posted who is on it, what level, what power, what height, power level, and frequency?
Well, that's going to fall under your survey of what is on the site, okay? So if you've done that proper survey and listing of all your sources, you're going to have that in a tabulation. You don't have to post it. Once again, the plan has to be available, all right? So if somebody comes along and says, hey, let me see your safety plan, you have to be able to pull it out and show it to them. But you don't necessarily have to have it posted at the base of the tower. The expectation is you're not going to have the general public climbing the tower anyway. And anybody that's there, is going to be there because they're authorized to be there.
You bring up an interesting question. Who would be interested or authorized to see your plan?
Yeah. Well, as we talked about, you're going to have staff involvement, okay? So you want to, obviously, the people that are in your facility that work there, the traffic people or sales, promotions, that type, they're going to want to see it. Insurance company's going to want to know if you've got it. And obviously, anybody that may be a contractor that's going to come in, they're going to want to see it as well. And if the contractors come in, remember, part of this is to make sure that they're aware, A, that you do have a plan, and also advise them of what procedures you expect and what controls are in place for their work to be done.
One point to consider, too, is to go over this with any people visiting the site or contractors. Have a safety meeting.
Absolutely.
Before you get to work. And a lot of times they're going to have it for their own purposes of the work that they're doing. But the RFR element can be folded right into that.
Yeah, and the expectation is if your contractors, especially like, for instance, our installers and our riggers, those guys, as part of their safety procedures that their company has in place, they should be cognizant of what's taking place. So yeah, you're right. It's very easy to roll that in. And that can be done if you've got a long-term project, you know, do it at the onset and then periodically come back. Just, hey, just a reminder, guys, we need to look over this again. Okay, about 2 minutes left. We hit that right on. All right. All right, thanks, everybody. Appreciate it. Good to see everybody.